Harsh criticism from Donald Trump aimed at one of his earliest political supporters. The U.S. president telling the New York Times on Wednesday that he wouldn't have appointed Jeff Sessions as attorney general and would have hired someone else if he'd known Sessions would recuse himself from the Russia investigation, a move described by Trump as being extremely unfair on him.
An early test for newly elected French President Emmanuel Macron. His armed forces chief has quit days after a heated dispute over defence budget cuts. Pierre de Villiers said on Wednesday, quote, I see myself as no longer able to guarantee the robust defence force I believe is necessary to guarantee the protection of France and the French people today and tomorrow, and to sustain the aims of our country.
What happened today on the Hill was a House subcommittee passed what was the first federal legislation related to autonomous car deployment. It still has to make its way through the full committee and then go to the floor for a vote. But this, it's a clear signal that there is, you know, a lot of interest here on Capitol Hill about this topic, and that there will soon be a regulatory framework to allow that to one day happen if the right things come to pass.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Thursday. It is July 20th, 2017. Welcome to the program. Another business day is upon us, and lots going on this morning, especially with healthcare. We had the CBO score yesterday from just repealing Obamacare. We will talk a little bit about the policy of all of that a little later in the program with an expert that will join us from the Chicago area. And in just a few minutes, it'll be our thought leader conversation. We have a fresh face, a new name, a new person with us today. We'll introduce you to Brett McKittrick in just a little bit. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning, it looks like it's going to be another tepid start to the day on Wall Street. Dow futures are up just 12 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are sideways to flat. The markets generally are higher in Asia this morning as we get ready to close, or just around the close there. The Nikkei is up 123 points. The Hang Seng up about 68. The other markets are up just single digits to just into the teens in Asia this morning. In London, all of the arrows are pointing up, and Europe as well. The DAX is up about a third. The FTSE is up about a half. And in France, the CAC is up about a quarter percent, 13 points this morning. Oil is trading at $47.10 a barrel, which is down just a fraction. Gold and silver are also off this morning. Stories we've been following for you. Americans are not too thrilled with Obamacare, and they definitely don't like the Republican plan offered by Congress. So what does the public want the government to do about health care? A new poll suggests the country may be shifting toward the political left, with 62% saying it is the federal government's responsibility to make sure that all Americans have health care coverage. 37% say it is not. The survey from the Associated Press shows a significant shift from March, when an earlier edition of the poll found a slim 52% majority saying coverage is a federal responsibility. Other polls this week have shown nearly 74% of the country don't like the Republican plan, and even more are opposed to just the basic repeal, which could come up for a vote as we move into the coming days. A key House panel has approved a Republican fiscal plan that probably won't deliver on its promises to balance the budget, but would begin to clear a path for a GOP effort to overhaul the tax code this fall. The Budget Committee approved the measure last night by a 22-14 vote that broke along party lines. The plan proposes deep cuts in safety net programs like Medicaid and food stamps, though Republicans would only try to deliver on a small fraction of those cuts. It faces an uphill battle in Congress. And President Donald Trump is calling hundreds of planned regulations. It's a move to bolster economic growth that administration officials say is only the start of gradual reshaping of the federal government. White House Budget Office says federal agencies have withdrawn 469 proposed regulations compared to a fall 2016 report when Barack Obama was president. That includes 19 regulations with an economic impact of $100 million or more. It's Thursday. That means it's our thought leader conversation. We're happy to have a new voice, a new face with us on our regular Thursday conversations. Brett McKittrick is an SVP and senior HR consultant at the Associated Bank, and he's with us here in studio this morning. Brett, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be here.
Happy to have you, too, join our circle of thought leaders. Let's talk a little bit about what you do at Associated Bank first.
Sure. I'm an attorney and an HR consultant, so I have a dual role where I help our organization with compliance aspects, as well as serve our clients on the benefits and risk consulting side in terms of HR issues and other benefits strategic planning issues.
HR issues would include what, if you had to dot them?
Sure. Corporate training, counseling on hirings and firings and ill and injured workers, a lot of leave laws, as you can imagine, confound employers these days.
Yeah, these are big deals, and it's sometimes very expensive, too, for employers to have this, isn't it, to make sure their T's are crossed and I's are dotted.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, with all the regulation designed to protect employees, which isn't a bad thing in theory, it does come at a cost. And a lot of employers don't necessarily have the internal resources to stay up with the law, for instance, and to train their own staff. And that's where we come in.
And your experience as an attorney, it almost is required, isn't it, to deal with some of this stuff because it is very legal.
Yeah, it's certainly helpful. I mean, it's a quagmire for employers. And trouble is, the law is not black and white, and we don't live in a black and white world net. And so a lot of what I do is explaining the gray to people and help them be comfortable with that gray and analyze the risk associated with that.
I give you all kinds of credit in the world for that, because the gray can sometimes be the worst part of the job, isn't it? I mean, you almost have to interpret sometimes what is meant by a rule.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and what it means to that particular employer. Like when we work with an employer, we can talk about the legal parameters within which they should operate, but we can also talk about real life and managing risk and managing that gray.
Well, it's good having you, because this is a nice thought leader area of discussion that we've been lacking, and so we're happy to add this to that. Speaking of gray and issues, healthcare. Yeah. Is front and center. It doesn't look like a vote is going to happen, at least this week, on this. Why should all of us be concerned about this, even if we're not enrolled in Obamacare?
Sure. And, you know, even that's a little bit of a misnomer. And I see senators or hear senators talk about being enrolled in Obamacare. It's really Obamacare provided health insurance for a lot of people that did not otherwise have access to health insurance, because insurance companies prior to 2010 could turn people away for pre-existing conditions or exclude people from coverage. The Affordable Care Act changed that. Now, how they changed it was by, you know, putting in place a lot of parameters that insurance companies had to play within, as well as employers that sponsored health insurance. So to your question about how does this impact maybe an employee of an organization with their employer-sponsored health insurance, for instance, well, there's something called the employer mandate that's part of the Affordable Care Act that says, hey, if you're an employer and have at least 50 full-time employees, you must offer some kind of affordable coverage to those full-time employees and their dependents. And if you don't, you as an employer may be faced with one of two types of penalties that the IRS would assess. Okay, that changed the game for employers. We saw back when this started and it came into effect in 2014, we saw many employers, especially in the hospitality industry, retail and restaurant industries, cut people's hours to avoid them having that full-time status, to avoid them paying health insurance. That changed the game for a lot of those individuals. If we take that provision away, what's that mean to an organization now? Are you going to go back and change people's hours again? Are you going to change your eligibility requirements? There's a lot of uncertainty in how employers will react depending on what parts of the Affordable Care Act are actually repealed and replaced with what.
And one of the positive things, too, about that, on the flip side of that coin, is it enabled smaller employers to pool together and actually offer insurance to employees. So there was that positive part of it as well.
Absolutely. I mean, there were plenty of positives and negatives associated with Obamacare, and not saying that from a political perspective, just from an employer-employee relationship perspective. And it certainly helped a lot of employers be able to offer coverage by changing the small market, the small group market rules with regard to how states regulate insurance plans.
One of the things that we've been hearing in the headlines is that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is dying. And that makes a lot of people uncomfortable when they hear that. What are the facts in this area? I mean, I'm sure you deal with this every day. Is it dying, and are we in jeopardy even if nothing happens here?
Yeah, great question. I think that depends on who you ask. And from an insurance carrier perspective, let's look at this as an example, because I think it really illustrates the point here and gets to your question. the individual mandate. That was the portion of the Affordable Care Act that said, hey, every taxpayer and taxpayer spouse and taxpayer's dependent must have some kind of minimum health insurance coverage. And if they do not, that taxpayer would be assessed a penalty. Okay, it was a reverse incentive. You know, America wants people to buy homes, so you give them mortgage deductions. This was a reverse incentive trying to get people to do what? Have health coverage. Now, that's how Obamacare enabled the 20 or 50 million or whatever the number was at the time to jump on to plans that they otherwise didn't have. Now, the quid pro quo with that was, in order to be able to do that and keep the health insurance companies from saying, hey, we don't want these people who were higher risk if they were uncovered before and maybe, quote unquote, a sicker population, was the guaranteed issue, the no pre-existing exclusions. If you make people have health insurance or incent them to have health insurance, you can't have an insurance company turning them away for a pre-existing condition. So in order for insurance companies to buy into that and actually offer coverage to this sicker population, that individual mandate had to be in place to require people to have coverage so that the insurance companies could enjoy healthier times of individuals having coverage and not just that higher risk pool. So back to your question, what that means is if we take away the individual mandate, like if this bill were to pass, for instance, and become law, and it gets rid of that individual mandate but keeps the pre-existing condition exclusion requirement, what happens to the insurance companies? Are they going to pull out? If, conversely, this bill fails and Obamacare remains as we've seen it, what we're seeing is insurance companies still pulling out of certain states. Look at Ohio, for instance, where insurance companies said, we cannot make any money in this individual market. The risk is still too high. That really is a state on a state-by-state basis, depending on what the market structure set up. So I think it's failing in some areas and succeeding in others.
One of the questions, too, we often hear is how quickly could all of this transpire? Let's say that they do come back and repeal and not replace. The question I hear most often is, how quickly will I lose my coverage, or how quickly could this impact my employer-provided coverage?
Sure. Well, first, it does have to go through the how a bill becomes a law. So if the Senate approves this, it's got to go back to the House. Then they go through it, and they must approve. And then it's got to go to the president's desk for him to sign it. If it gets through all of that, it could happen retroactively in terms of the employer mandate and the individual mandate. Right. So in terms of how this might affect a taxpayer or an employer from a tax penalty perspective, it would affect him going back to 1/1/2016. Now, to your question about what would that mean for our coverage, people probably wouldn't be touched for 2017 because all of the marketplace plans are in place for a year. And they're set up on a calendar year basis. But it would certainly affect what plans are being offered beginning 1/1/18.
Boy, even in this discussion that you and I are having here, it's incredibly complicated. And it's becoming obvious that it's almost like a house of cards.
Yeah.
Before we went in the air, you mentioned it's sort of like a quilt with a thread. You pull one part of it. It is extremely complicated.
It really is. And I think that's one of the problems with the straight repeal and don't replace. That's being suggested now as well. If we don't have great replacement options that people can agree on, let's just get rid of it. Well, I think there's a little bit of danger in that going back to 2010. Think of 2010. That was so long ago. We were still eating gluten in 2010, right? And so in that regard, turning back the clock probably isn't going to be the best answer for all patients, consumers, and quite frankly, even the health insurance companies, because they've made plenty of changes just to get up to speed to where they are right now.
You, from your vantage point, are people benefiting generally from this? Are employers and companies benefiting from having this insurance in place?
I think they have come to a point where they're working through the challenges of it, the compliance obligations, for instance, that employers are facing now that they didn't before Obamacare. I think in that regard, they've worked through these. They're sort of on, I hesitate to say autopilot, but things are running somewhat smoothly for them. And I don't think it's a real detriment to currently have it for a lot of employers.
And it seems to be on a very basic non-political level. If you have a healthy workforce, you're going to have a healthy company.
You're absolutely right in a number of different areas. Employee wellness, even beyond health, is so important for absenteeism rates, engagement, productivity at work. And having people with health insurance and setting their minds at ease, whether they're getting that through their employer or as an individual through the marketplace, does make a happier and healthier employee.
We could talk about healthcare all day, but I want to change topics here because one of the other things that we've been seeing about it and on Capitol Hill and in some boardrooms and office structures is dress code has been in the news.
Sure.
We saw the House, House Speaker's office, they're going to start going back over the dress code of the House because of, new modern ways of dressing and probably cooler ways of dressing in Washington, D.C. in the summertime. But Goldman Sachs is also looking at this, one of the big financial firms, about their outmoded dress code. Why is this back in the news? Why are we talking about this?
Yeah, I think it's more of a function of changing jobs. You look at Goldman Sachs, a quarter of their 33,000 employees are engineers. Why are they engineers? Because of technology, right? And how that affects trading in the stock market, for instance. Well, when you have, let's be honest, how did engineers dress in the 70s? Probably not the pinnacle of fashion, right?
Yeah.
And so I think because you have more IT individuals, you have more jobs in this engineering category, I think it's necessitating a change along with the changing population and younger generation and attitude toward formalities.
Younger workers generally don't wear ties. The millennial crowd wasn't brought up that way. They probably don't even know. They're not suit and tie people. I just rarely see them. Is that too? Is it a demographic thing where you have younger people just all have a different style?
I think so. And I think it's who raised the millennials, the baby boomers. Mm-hmm. Well, what did the baby boomers do? They did one of two things. Either they completely eschewed their parents' perspective on dress and didn't wear a tie themselves and rebelled against it, or what the millennials see when they are growing up, mom or dad take that tie off, take that formal dress off or business suit off the second they get home. So I think it's in how they were raised and how their attitudes were shaped in that regard.
And this probably brings up one of those hot button issues, or maybe just a sandpit issue, where a company says, okay, we want you to dress a business casual, or we want you to dress, and they give you a term. How do you determine that if you're an employee and you say, okay, dress smart, if that's the edict?
Right. Great question. I think a lot of employers are struggling with that communication. You know, they issue an edict like that, but what's it really mean to the employee? And I think that's where good communication comes in from a corporate cultural perspective. Whether it's from the HR or individual departments or managers, it's really trying to communicate to people by both telling them, maybe even in writing, or by showing them what this looks like and what it means.
I would imagine that as the job market tightens up, human resources issues like dress codes it's important, isn't it, to maintain that workforce and keep talented people?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something the millennial generation, you know, the people in their 20s and 30s entering the workforce or young in their work lives right now. Multiple surveys, there's a recent Gallup survey earlier this year that showed that culture is just as important to these individuals as salary or compensation. Now, that's not to say for all other generations that they don't care about culture and they'd work at a place that was terrible to them. But it does show you the changing attitude in that a person will leave maybe because of a dress code or because of how it's even communicated to them.
Yeah, I remember starting out in broadcasting, I was had to wear a tie and a coat every day. And I was told by one boss, well, if you wear a tie, people respect you. Now, nobody wears a tie anymore.
Yeah, it almost has the opposite effect.
Yeah. Well, Brett, it's good chatting with you, and we're going to have lots more to talk about in the future, and I can't wait to have more discussions with you.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
And Brett McKittrick is the Senior Vice President, Senior HR Consultant at Associated Benefits, part of Associated Bank, and our Thought Leader Conversation. We do those every Thursday morning here on The Opening Bell. And you can find our past conversations at the Associated Bank and also the Opening Bell page on our website, WGNRadio.com. All of our past conversations are there.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. Glad to have you here for our Thursday edition of the program. Republicans struggling to agree on health care legislation to overhaul or replace Obamacare. Met last night at the White House, went last night late into the night, and we're told that Republicans attending the meeting even sent their staff away in order to talk frankly about it. Almost all of the senators, though, rushed off after the meeting without comment. So it's unclear where things stand. Now, possibly a motion to proceed on repeal. We thought we'd bring in Dr. Matt Davis this morning. He's a professor of pediatrics and of medicine at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. And he's an expert in these areas, especially with health policy, population health, and healthcare research for children and adults. Dr. Davis, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Glad to be with you, Steve.
So let's talk about this. If the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, came out yesterday with the report on whether or not on just proceeding with repealing Obamacare, 32 million uninsured in about 10 years. Talk to us about where this all stands and where you see it going.
Steve, the latest report from the Congressional Budget Office reminds us that even before the Affordable Care Act was put in place, our private insurance system had some main vulnerabilities to it that was leading people to be priced out of the market and have a more difficult time affording their private insurance plans. That was pushing us towards higher and higher rates of uninsurance to begin with. So the Affordable Care Act was put in place. Obamacare has led to coverage for about 20 million people who otherwise would be pushed out of coverage or find it unaffordable. If we repeal Obamacare, we're going to go back to that original trajectory that we had back before 2010.
It seems that that would be, it's almost unthinkable to head back there. 7 years now we've had the Affordable Care Act in place. What have you been seeing in terms of people actually getting care, and are people better off in terms of their health care now than they were 7 years ago?
There's no question in my mind, as a primary care doctor seeing patients with new coverage who hadn't had it for years and years before, that the Affordable Care Act has really permitted people to get health care who otherwise would not be getting it in a meaningful way. They might be able to go to the emergency department for something that happened suddenly, but they wouldn't be able to have that relationship with a doctor that so many of us really value and treasure, especially if we have a long-term condition like heart disease or diabetes or high blood pressure. So it's pretty clear that coverage does matter for people, and I think actually that's why we've seen the Republican caucus not be able to come to consensus on this, because especially on the moderate side, they've emphasized the value of this coverage for so many people in their states.
You know, we often hear that I think it's probably your oath that you do no harm when it comes to dealing with patients. I'm hearing you say that this could really do some harm to our population if they just outright repeal this and don't do it the right way.
Well, we know from research that when you lose coverage, you lose access. And when you lose access, you lose the ability to manage certainly the sudden things that can happen, and especially the long-term problems, like I was mentioning earlier, the diabetes and heart disease, those being common challenges that many, many millions, tens of millions of Americans face. There's another part of this, though, which is that when you lose your insurance coverage, you also lose one of the best defenses we have against personal bankruptcy. And something that's happened that hasn't been in the news as much over the past few years, and certainly during this current conversation about reform, is that personal bankruptcies have really gone down since the major parts of Affordable Care Act coverage came into place.
And that's because the horror stories, too, before these numbers started going down, people were really, some made homeless because of the overwhelming health care debt. Others, as you said, have filed for bankruptcy because of that. Let me ask you this, Doctor. We often hear the lawmakers say, well, and this is on both sides of the aisle, there are things about it that need to be fixed, Obamacare, for the Affordable Care Act. What are those things, and are they easy fixes?
The main thing that Democrats and Republicans agree needs to be fixed, Steve, are these so-called marketplaces, the insurance exchanges that were set up and supported by federal subsidies to allow consumers to purchase plans in the private insurance market. What's happened is that not enough healthy people came in to buy those plans. So essentially what you've had is what healthcare and insurance experts call adverse selection, meaning we have a bunch of people buying those plans who really, really need them. That means that the spending on those health insurance plans for the health insurer's perspective has been higher than expected. That becomes a problem from the business side because those insurers say, whoa, we have way too many people spending on healthcare than we expected. We've got to bump up the premiums in order to make up the difference. And you can see that spiral upward is making plans less and less affordable. One of the fixes for that is to put in place essentially a buffer for those insurance plans so that they will enroll their consumers as best they can. But if it ends up that the people enrolled in those plans have spent more than they expected or far more than they expected, there's relief for those insurance plans. The general name for this idea is called a risk corridor. But the basic idea is that it's a buffer. It's a soft landing for insurers who find themselves on the wrong side of the balance sheet at the end of the year.
It is was stunning to me that with this the replace that the senators had been working on, that pretty much all of the healthcare groups and doctors groups and insurance groups were all united in their opposition to it. I don't think I've ever seen that in terms of a bill before. That should be some sort of guidepost, shouldn't it?
You're right. There's tremendous consensus of people who work in healthcare and for whom healthcare is what we do and what we're spending our careers working on, that the Affordable Care Act has improved the situation for millions and millions of Americans. It has cost federal money in order to do that. And I think that's the basic debate we're having in Washington right now. Has it been good value for that amount of federal spending that we've had and for the amount of difference that it's made for our patients? That, I think, is a calculation that people are going to differ about in terms of the value proposition. But I'll tell you, as a person who takes care of many people who have gotten coverage under the Affordable Care Act, there's no question that it has been a positive difference maker.
And the other thing that I think most people would not argue about, especially those who deal with the economy on a daily basis, is you're really playing with fire here. This is 1/6 of the economy. And if you pull the plug on some of this stuff, it's going to have a major impact.
Well, you're so right about that. In fact, I published a piece a couple weeks ago looking at where has the job growth been in the American economy over the past 10 years. And there's no question that the healthiest job sector has been healthcare. And that's especially true since January 2014 when we expanded coverage to the Affordable Care Act. So if we were to put this in reverse, we're talking about undercutting the healthiest part of the American jobs market. And that, I think, as you're pointing out, puts us really at risk in terms of our overall economy.
Dr. Davis, good of you to be with us this morning here on the Opening Bell. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Matt Davis is a professor of pediatrics and medicine at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, an expert in health policy, population health, and the Affordable Care Act, public health insurance as well. So we appreciate him offering a little insight to us this morning. Again, the meeting went late into the night last night involving Republican senators, and they all walked away without commenting. Unclear where things stand this morning, but we'll keep you posted.
You're listening to the Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning, Dow futures up 11, NASDAQ and S&P futures are flat. The latest now on commodities and agriculture. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. It was a green sheet day in the grain market yesterday, with September wheat ending a half cent higher, September corn up 6 1/4, and August soybeans ended the day yesterday up 9 3/4 cents. Seeing gains yesterday following the previous day's trade, and corn and soy prices came off their session highs at midday. Investors adjusted their positions to match the latest weather. The weather models, according to one trader, are jumping around. Yesterday, around this time of day, they went wetter. This time, the heat is there, and so that's what changed and had the impact on the grain market. Meanwhile, a pretty good rebound in livestock trade at the Mercantile Exchange yesterday. August lean hogs up $2.02 a hundredweight. August live cattle up $2.37. And August feeder cattle up $3.35 a hundredweight. Futures gained sharply thanks to short covering in response to higher than expected cash prices. And also fund buying contributed to market advances. Well, we're getting into the season of county fairs close into the Chicago area, and you've got one starting today just a few miles west at St. Charles. The Kane County Fair opens today, and it runs through Sunday. Incidentally, the Heart of Illinois Fair at Peoria also underway through Sunday. County Fair at Iroquois County in Crescent City underway. So go out and enjoy a county fair and get ready for the state fairs in the Midwest coming up shortly. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Thursday, July 20th, the Labor Department releases weekly jobless claims today. Freddie Mac releases weekly mortgage rates. Transportation giant Union Pacific reports quarterly financial results. Microsoft and Visa also out with their quarterly earnings after the market closes. Some other big events happening today. Fortune magazine reveals its annual global Fortune 500 ranking of the world's largest corporations according to revenue. Forbes' highest paid author list comes out today as well. Senators Lindsey Graham and Dick Durbin of Illinois hold a news conference today on their Dream Act of 2017, which would allow a select group of young immigrant students to earn lawful permanent residence and have access to path towards citizenship. Comic-Con International begins in San Diego, and the Senate Judiciary Committee will vote today on the nomination of Christopher Wray to be the new FBI director. Some of the things that could move the markets on this Thursday, July 20th.